Sloppy Spoilers with your host, DT2. Hello, and welcome to another episode of Sloppy Spoilers. I'm your host, David Taylor II. You know me as DT2 Comics Chat on Twitter. Today, we're going to be talking about Season 2, Episode 5 of The Umbrella Academy and The Boys. I'd like to welcome my co-host. Welcome to David Nemesis Howard. And where can we find you on Twitter, Dave?
You can all find me at NemesisFC2 on Twitter. And glad to be here. Glad to be talking to all of you. Slowly but surely, we are getting through 2020.
Ain't that the truth? Welcome to Steve Shadewing Sellers. How are you doing, Steve? And where can we find you on Twitter?
Doing pretty well. You can find me over at Shadewing. And I would say that not only are we getting through 2020, we're getting through the middle of these two seasons not too badly.
All right. And we're going to give a welcome to Jeff Dr. Faye Bracey. How are you doing, Jeff?
I am so glad to be here as always. You can find me at Bracey452 on Twitter. And like Picard, 2022 shall pass.
Wow. But Picard won't.
I have forgotten about that show. Thank you very much.
Yep, that's what I'm here for.
I saw Girardi on some other show. I was like, wait, that's Girardi. Anyway.
Out.
We're going to start with Season 2, Episode 5 of The Umbrella Academy, entitled Valhalla, or Valhalla, however you might want to pronounce it. Quick recap. I hate to say that this episode was everybody sitting around talking about feelings, but this episode was everybody sitting around talking about feelings. There's only about two events that actually pushed the plot forward. Everything else was, I won't say fluff and I won't say filler, but for a show that is normally chock full of shocking things that happen or whatever, it really didn't have a lot in this episode. So it was basically the family reunion episode. They all get back together and they all kind of reconnect. And it's really funny that Vanya still has amnesia, because she's responsible for so much and so many things happen that she doesn't remember. So we get a big kick out of looking at that. And but besides that, you know, then they decide to do what they're going to do about why they're there, about Hargreaves, their father's involvement with JFK. And then we have a little bit of action with Lila and the Swedish triplets. And that's really about it. So the episode starts out with giving us the background on Pogo, their IntelliChimp, and how he got that way. And so they were using him in experiments, and they put him in a rocket. Things went wrong. Of course they did. And they said, we can rebuild him. We have the technology. Don't worry about that reference if you don't get it. And got a shot from Hargreaves. That's right. He got a shot from Hargreaves and basically became the Pogo that we know. That's how the episode starts. And then everything that happens from that until they all get back together in the academy doesn't really matter a lot. But anyway, so right off the bat, I'd like to get some first impressions of this episode from you guys. Don't hold back. Let her rip, because I want to hear what you have to say. So let's start with Nemesis. What do you think overall about this episode?
I think I'm with you on a lot of it. I think a lot of it was just laying groundwork for stuff. Vanya's amnesia, I definitely want to talk about when we get to it. One thing I did like, and I hope we talk about, was the plot or the little machinations that we saw come to fruition with the three Swedish brothers. I thought that was interesting. I thought that was clever. I liked how that played out. Everything else was, I think you hit it right on the head. I don't think it was fluff. I mean, I think it advanced the plot, but there wasn't a whole lot of action. And for an episode titled Valhalla, this really needed another fight scene a la the Kiss one, except with the immigrant song this time, you know, take it back for Marvel. So
go ahead, Steve, initial thoughts.
Oh my God, I was so bored with most of this episode. There were a few exceptions. I mean, the starting business with Pogo at least was interesting because it gave us some important backstory on how he became intelligent, and you know, establishing some of the relationships, you know, establishing a little bit more about the mother of the Abelial Academy and her relationship with Hargreaves. There was a little bit of that was worthwhile. The Viking funeral with the rowboat at the end was nice. Like that was like the closest to an emotional moment I had in watching this entire episode. And in fact, what had happened was that I had stopped the episode like before the last 7 minutes or so, and I had absolutely forgotten to come back to the show like for days after that. And when I brought this up to someone, she said, well, you really must not have been that invested in it if you were holding on it from that long. And I thought about it, and I'm like, you know what? You got a point. I wasn't all that invested. I was just bored with the whole thing. And honestly, I am getting tired of all of these characters and their relationship troubles and all these people pining left and right and not doing anything. I am so tired of it. And that's what most of this episode was. And it was just disappointing compared to the rest. It wasn't like god awful. It wasn't like, you know, Deep Skills levels of annoying, but it was just a lot of like having to sit through a lot of stuff that I didn't care about and asking myself, why was I pushing myself through this other than to like discuss it for the show?
Now, we're going to come back to that in a minute. A lot of stuff that we didn't care about and the one noted nature of everything. So we're definitely going to revisit that. Go ahead, Bracey. Let's hear your initial thoughts.
Oh, man, I'm on board with Steve. For me, the only part of this show that really, really mattered was the opening. I like getting the intro of IntelliChimp. I liked that actually it answered a question we had about Hargreaves. We're wondering about his state of mind in regards to his wife and, you know, and making the robot version of her. And we say, like, oh, okay, he's not 100% pure science. He does actually have a slice of humanity to him. So that'll be interesting to explore to see what happens and what makes him be the father that raises up the Umbrella Academy. So that was really cool. And plus, once again, the Umbrella Academy kills it. And this is one where they have it over the boys. They pick a great piece of music for this whole thing. The whole Major Tom song with the astronaut chimp. Pitch perfect, just like the Kiss fight. And as Steve said, like, I am so on board with Steve. This episode bored me. I have so many problems with this episode for a show that I generally like. And the fact that nothing happens. The only one who really drives the action ever is Five. Yeah. And, you know, as an ensemble show, more of the characters need to drive the action. They need to be active protagonists, not reactive protagonists. You can't just have one guy do it. And it, once again, it just illustrates there's only really one character that we would probably keep watching again and again if they had a spinoff series, and that's Five. So I have problems with that, and I know we'll get into it in more detail, but I also have a really big problem with the fact that now that the family's finally back together, everybody's just like, you know, a couple of them are like, oh, you know, Vanya, you suck. Like, but I'm sorry. Okay. No. This is Dark Phoenix. This is Hal Jordan's Parallax. I'm sick of comic book characters just like getting the free pass after they've destroyed the world or something. No, that's BS.
Well, I agree with that. And jumping back to what Steve was saying, because I was kind of bored and got kind of sleepy. I'm like, I got things to do. And watching this for reviewing for our podcast. But when you don't give the characters a reason to exist in the story other than the one thing that they do, that's what makes you get kind of tired or flat episodes. I'll give you an example of someone that does it right. A show that does it right is Firefly.
Oh, yeah.
And the reason that Firefly does it right is because Firefly will show you, sometimes just in, contained in one episode, why everyone's there. Wash is the pilot. Mal is the captain, because they live in a time and a situation where somebody's got to make the hard choices. And none of them are really good at that like he is. Inara more than once has used her ambassador career to get them out of situations or get them into situations they couldn't have gotten into any other way, because they're a bunch of thieves, except for her. Zoe, loyal soldier backup, always has eyes in the back of her head, can think tactically better than anybody, including Mal, on and on and on. So, see, they have a reason to be there. Kaylee, no one can ever possibly caress those engines like her. But on Umbrella Academy, we don't feel that way if you think about it. Like, why are you here? What are you doing? We know why Five is there, because you're driving everything. It would be would not be happening without you easily. We know why Hargreaves is there, because you're the Professor X, the Niles Calder of the story. Okay. But everybody else, can we lift you out? And the story's the same. And so sometimes, most of the time, that answer is yes. And that's why we're feeling that fatigue. So let's get into their actual reunion time. Now, one thing that they did really, really well was that they finally dealt with some of the pink elephants in the room, as it were. The biggest one being how ridiculously gross it is that Luther's hung up on Allison. Because that's your sister, son. And, you know, Vanya's... Amnesia comes into play there, because they keep making all these references to last season. And Bonnie's like, what? And she's like, wait a minute. Luther's hung up on Allison? And she's like, don't worry about it. And Allison's like, well, we haven't, you know, haven't even kissed. I'm like, what a thing to say. So, you know, they're dealing with that. They're dealing with what Jeff just mentioned, that, you know, Diego's the only one that comes out and says what you just said. This is a Dark Phoenix ticking time bomb type of situation. And the last time I saw her, she had energy tentacles around my neck. So no, I have the, you know, the right to ask a few questions or whatever he said. So they finally deal with that. But other than that, again, oh yeah, and they deal with their father's involvement with JFK's death, which is pretty much the entire point of the whole season. And they spend the least amount of time on that. That's the part that just had me scratching my head. I'm like, remember how you hear me talk about all the time about where you put the camera?
Mm-hmm.
I'm like, don't nobody want to see yet one more scene of Klaus getting high, trying to numb his pain, and Ben giving him snark from over in the corner, and Vanya apologizing, because that's all they do. But anyway, give me your thoughts on the actual reunion scene, what you liked, what you didn't like, what you think they could have done differently or better. Start with Steve.
Well, I like that they finally had this scene. I will say that, because it's been episode after episode of waiting for them to get together and waiting for them to get together. And they finally get together and you get some, you know, good interactions back and forth between them. You see Five laying out his case. Five always is the most interesting character wherever he's in usually. And that was true here as well. The problem is that they get together. And then, you know, they go back and forth on what they're going to do. And their answer is they're going to do nothing. And it's back to, like, one of the things that I keep coming back to is the fact that these are the worst qualified people to prevent an apocalypse. And in fact, they're probably better at starting an apocalypse than preventing it, because every time these people are together, you know, they want to kill each other, or they have these disagreements, or someone acts like an idiot, and nothing gets done. And this is exactly what happened. Nothing gets done. And it's like, well, our plan is we're going to go and talk to our dad. And they're criticizing him for this. And it's like, well, what other leads do you have? All you really have is that picture and the fact that you know that Hargreaves is involved in this. So, you know, why is, you know, going up there and talking to him about what's going on a bad idea? I mean, even Diego agrees that, you know, he's mixed up with this and they should do something about it, Hargreaves. No, it's, you know, we don't want to talk to you. We don't want to talk to him. And we don't want to indulge your daddy issues for some reason. And it's like all of you have daddy issues. What's different about now? Especially since at this point you have hard evidence that Hargreaves is involved. So it just seemed like they were trying to drag things out again and not do anything for another episode, and I'm getting a little fed up with the going through the motions, especially after all this time that we've gone through all this time trying to set up this meeting, and then the meeting goes nowhere.
That's right. It definitely should have had more punch to it, and it just kind of fizzled like flat soda pop. Go ahead, Bracey.
The only thing I really liked about this scene was when they just start to discuss the apocalypse, actually. And they're just like, well, you know, has anybody, you know, have any of us actually done anything to change the timeline? And there's that kind of pregnant pause, like when your parents are asking you, like, who broke the vase that was standing in the hallway or something, and everybody kind of looks around, and they all just turn on each other like siblings do when they know they're busted, like, oh, like Klaus started a cult. Like, you're working for Jack Ruby. Oh, yeah, well, she married a black activist. You know, and, like, that was fun for me. I thought that was so in tone with, like, a bunch of siblings, you know, all the finger pointing going back and forth. I like that bit. But it's like Steve said, everything else just kind of falls apart. Now, these seasons are only, like, 10 episodes long. We're halfway into it, and we're just getting the gang back together. And we haven't even really scratched the surface of Dad's involvement in things. So, I don't know. When you've only got 10 episodes in a season, you don't have time for filler. And a lot of this just, this episode feels like filler. I wish that their coming together would have been a lot more impactful, especially when you consider, yeah, they've been trapped in time anywhere from like, you know, a few years to a few months in this scenario. But this is the first time these people have been apart since they were children. You think the reunion would be a lot more intense and interesting than that. Or maybe they would come to some realization like, oh, you know, wow, we really can kind of make lives for ourselves on our own to a degree. But it just, you know, I'm with you, DT. It just felt like it kind of fizzled for me mostly.
Well, I would have liked to have seen some type of plan that requires each one of their powers.
Mm-hmm.
That overall plan won't work unless they all participate. So not only do they have a reason to be there, but any type of exposition after that point will be Five saying, we need you because this. Because all Five ever says is, we have to stop this. As opposed to, this is your part in helping us stop this. Very, very different. Go ahead, Nemesis.
Yeah, I mean, I heard you guys say a lot of things that pretty much hit around exactly the way I feel about this scene, which is this whole scene pretty much encapsulates what I think is wrong with the Umbrella Academy as it's moving forward, and that, like DT said, the only one who needs to be there at this point really is Five. All the other ones are doing are making problems for him. If they all went away or they just stayed there talking for another five episodes, Five would probably be better off. He probably solved the problem faster, you know? So there's that. Then you got the whole thing with, you know, they're arguing back and forth on daddy issues. It's just the whole thing feels played. And I agree with, I think it was Steve who said that they all have daddy issues, which I think is absolutely true.
Yeah.
Vanya's amnesia, which is one of the most convenient plot points ever, because if she didn't have amnesia, you would have to write some probably very riveting drama with her having to deal with coming to grips with what she did, or she become a villain. It's one or the other. You know, it's either she accepts that what she did and has no qualms about it at all, or she has to deal with that. Either one of those things would be infinitely more interesting than this garbage that we got, and her whole storyline in this whole episode was just more ridiculousness piled on more ridiculousness. I mean, how it ended up was ridiculous as well, you know, her expectations and everything, and maybe we'll get to that. I mean, I just really frustrated with that. And then finally I'll say, you know, we talked about how all these other characters shouldn't be there. Well, up until recently, I hadn't read the comics, and I started reading them, and then Shadewing got me into the new series that came out from Dark Horse that follows Klaus. And I was like, well, Klaus is pretty much, you know, a one-trick buffoon in the series. How good could this be? But Shadewing was like, yeah, check it out. So I did, and I read it.
Mm-hmm.
Klaus is fascinating in that
book.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely fascinating, which makes what they've done to him in Umbrella Academy, the TV series, absolutely criminal.
Yeah, they've exaggerated him for the purposes of the show, and they've taken away all the depth and the layers that Gerard Way gave him.
Right, plus a lot of the interesting powers he has as well.
Yeah.
You know, and that goes for a bunch of them. And then I think that goes right back to DT's point, which is, if you're doing this, you want to make this a true ensemble show, the plan should have been something that hits on all of their powers, because all of them have unique skills that could have been used in a very interesting way to deal with this. I mean, set rumor loose within the FBI to start saying rumors and stuff to get information. That could be an interesting episode. A lot of things you could do, and they don't. And we're getting the same tired old themes. It seems like I saw this fight happen last season, because I did. You know? So I think it's starting to wear thin. And there's going to be a season 3, I can imagine. And I can only hope that it is... uses its characters better than this season is doing so far.
Absolutely. They definitely need to. Let's talk about a few moments that were somewhat key. The most obvious key moment we'll do first, and that is when Diego is trailing around after Luther, you know, trying to talk him back into what's going on. And they had an interesting interchange about how, you know, Luther's daddy issues and, you know, Diego's daddy issues. And Diego's like, no, I see fine. He's a jerk. I'm wonderful. I get it. You don't, but I get it. I thought that was funny. But then, of course, there's a limo that's been trailing them ever since Luther left. And the driver gets out and hands them an invitation. And it's basically Hargreaves inviting them to get together with him. So next time there's a reunion, it'll include the dad. That's another kind of like teaser trailer moment to what we really want to see.
Mm-hmm.
But it doesn't happen this episode. So it's just a, okay, well, you got to keep watching because this is going to happen next. There's that. And then the other pivotal moment is when Vanya confronts Sissy about, you know, their night together and about how they were talking about leaving together. And it doesn't do it as effectively as any of the civil rights scenes, any of the sit-ins, the nonviolent protests or the riots. But it does try to put some weight on the fact that two women and a child trying to make a life for themselves in the early 60s would be an extreme challenge. It didn't even hit me until I was reading some stuff later, which shows you the difference between then and now. It didn't even hit me about how, if they did run away, how in the world could they explain their relationship? Because Vanya's functioning out of what life is like now. And Sissy is like, I can't leave my husband. I can't be a single mom. I certainly can't be a part of a, you know, lesbian couple with a kid and all this. And none of that really hit me like the civil rights stuff did, but it hit me later. I was like, oh, okay. What Vanya was actually asking Sissy to do. And it speaks to the challenge of time travel love. Now, they tried to do that with Klaus, but basically Klaus just basically bombed a relationship before he got in it. Trying to save his life. But this one with Sissy and Vanya, they actually talk about, what do you do if you're from a whole other period in time and it does not occur to you that someone else doesn't have, nor could they function on your values? So let's talk about that. Let's talk about either way. Let's talk about if you went backwards or forwards in time and you fell in love with someone and they were in a not good situation and you're trying to get them out of that situation based on the norms we have now, and they try to let you know that this is not going to work. How would you respond to that? So let's say if we went back in time and you're dating a minority woman Because they definitely would have killed you if you that mixed race stuff. They were definitely still killing people in the 60s for having stuff like that going on. So what would you do, like, if that was your situation? Start with Nemesis.
Yeah, you know, it's an interesting thing you bring up, and it really does get to what I wanted to talk about with Vanya as well. You know, I think that, for me personally, I think you have to be aware of the time you're living in, you know, and just realize that no matter what your sensibilities are, you know, going forwards or backwards, if you go forward in time, they may look at you and your values as being barbaric. You know, it really just depends. And that's been true, you know, for as long as humanity has existed. We look back in time and the progress, and we can't understand, we have a difficult time understanding how people can believe certain things or act in certain ways. And we don't put it in context. And this goes to Vanya. And this is my problem with Vanya's characters, because Vanya is supposed to be a very smart woman. And she is a smart woman. And I think she, of all of them, was pretty well grounded. Even though she's got her emotional problems and some other problems, she was pretty well grounded in the first series. And for her to not understand that what she is asking of that lady, I can't remember her name, is impossible. You know, it's impossible on many different levels. It would probably be almost near to impossible or very difficult now, because you're asking a woman to, you know, or a person, doesn't even have to be a woman. It could be if you're in a three-way relationship, but you're asking someone to leave their spouse, leave the comfort of a home that they've established. Even if they're unhappy, people don't like change. You know, it's just understanding of basic human nature. That's why there are so many people out there that have extramarital affairs when they're not in love with their spouse, but they stay in the affair and don't want to leave their spouse because they don't want to leave what they know, you know? And it's just about understanding and reading people and understanding basic psychology. And to me, Vanya is definitely smart enough to understand at least where Sissy is coming from, even if it upsets her, you know? And to me, Vanya acted like a spoiled child that did not make any effort to think outside of herself and what she was asking, how that would affect a multitude of different people, including the person she supposedly loves.
Well, if I went back and I was alive during my dad's time and I was in the South and I had a relationship with a white woman, that's pretty much the end of our lives once we go public with that. And that's the same with the children. If you produce mulatto children, if we're talking about back in the 60s.
I think a lot of that depends on where you live, but I agree with you. I mean, I don't want to give away too much, but my parents, I mean, they grew up in Southern California, and my dad is Mexican and my mom is white. And that was, I think they had issues. I think they had problems, but I don't think they ever, I've never really talked to them about it, to be honest with you, but I've never heard them say that they felt like their life was threatened. So I think it depended on where you lived in the country as well.
Well, he did preface it by saying if he was in the South at the time.
Oh, well, yeah.
Yeah, definitely. It's over. You go public with something like that. And I still find those concepts fascinating. I definitely agree with what you said, that when you're dealing with standards and mores and you're decades apart, that could almost even be true with what they used to call a May-December relationship, meaning you're significantly older than the person you're dating, because they're definitely going to feel differently about some things than you do based on the time you were raised in. Go ahead.
I would just add real quick. Sometimes it's things that have nothing to do. I mean, we keep hitting on these hot buttons, what we consider hot button social issues. But depending on how far back time you go, just saying that you don't go to church could be a sin that could have gotten you stoned or killed. You know, so, you know, you go back far back in time and you don't realize where you are and what culture you're living in, and you make an offhanded comment like, I'm not religious and I don't go to church, you could have been killed for that. So
I'm not going to get too deep into this because I want to hear from Steve and Bracey, but I'm watching how Christianity is being redefined now. Here in 2020, the time we live in now. Mm-hmm. And how many people are shaping a narrative about what Christianity is and it isn't. And that's really something, but I could do a whole hour on that by myself. So go ahead, Steve. What do you think about time jumping, falling in love, and what that means on social and moral levels?
Okay. The first thing I'm going to kind of point out as far as this episode goes is just that this whole thing with Vanya and Sissy was like the most excruciating thing to watch the entire show. And part of it is Vanya. And I have to say, you know, she comes across as being ridiculously naive. I can't believe that she would think, yeah, she's going to come along with me and everything's going to end happily ever after. And I'm like, hey, have you read nothing? Do you not know anything about your history? Have you done nothing to understand like the time you're living in? You've lived in this time period for what, the last couple of years? You should at least be aware of exactly the kind of expectations that people have and exactly how gays would have been treated back then. And I'm pretty sure it would not have been with open arms. I'm just thinking like just 30 years ago, it looks like when I was growing up, it was, you know, just being into Dungeons and Dragons was something that was really seriously frowned on in certain quarters in the South. And that was just back then. And you're talking about something that's not even all that significant. But when you're talking about homosexuality and you're dealing with a religion that sees it as a sin, and you're dealing with the Deep South that is really seriously religious about all this, and, you know, yeah, they would probably have killed them. They probably would have stoned them or lynched them or burned them. I mean, they back then they might very well have done that. So, and I can't believe that this would never have occurred to Vanya, that this would have happened. And taking the kid out of the situation, you think that the father is just going to let that go? You think he's not going to try to get custody of the kid? You think he's not going to try to bring the wife back? I mean, no thought of consequences whatsoever. She's just lit in her romantic dream world and she's not thinking at all. As far as like what I would do, it's like if I have a time machine, I take her out and go to forward. But if I don't have access to a time machine, I mean, you really have to think like, you know, is there any chance that this relationship could possibly work? And with some of these, no, it really wouldn't. And I don't think that I would want to get in the middle of that just because, you know, you're risking your life, on an impulse. I think you have to put a lot of thought into it one way or another. I'm not saying that, you know, it might not be worth it if it were the right person. But, you know, when you're talking about this kind of risk, you have to at least think it out about what you're going to do, how you're going to involve this person, how you're going to persuade them to do what you're going to do, you know, how you're going to hide this, because there's no way you could bring something like that to light if you can help it. It's just all these kinds of practical considerations. And none of that is in this. And she's coming in with her 2020s mindset, you know, looking at all of this and acting as though everything's going to be hunky-dory, especially when you don't have five to take you back to the future. I mean, you'd think that she would be less naive than this. I mean, it's just, yeah. So this whole thing is absurd. And unfortunately, it's... The whole situation is likely to end in tragedy just because of not only the situation itself, but the absolute lack of common sense displayed by everyone.
Well, I agree with both of those points that, number one, Vanya should be smarter than that, even with her amnesia. But number two, she's been there long enough to, you know, even though she is a little bit isolated on the farm and there's no internet, but still, she's still... ought to have acclimated to what life was like back then and not think that her schoolgirl crush had any real chance of being anything more than that. Go ahead, Bracey.
You know, American Horror Story, and it's, I believe it's second season, The Asylum, actually covered this subject quite well because they had a couple of characters who were dealing with being gay and being in a mixed relationship during that particular season. And both of them were handled really well. You really got to see how ostracized it was. In fact, there were laws in the books that you could not marry outside of your race. And even if that wasn't the case in your particular state, you suffered social ridicule, social isolation, potential, you know, there were such things as, you know, like fag bashing, as well as the harassment that people of color got from organizations like the Klan. So, yeah, it was potentially quite dangerous. And here's Vanya, who's supposed to be such a smart character, and I just hate her this season. She's ridiculous. First of all, nothing that she's doing out on that farm has ever mattered in the context of this part of the series. She is just isolated. She's alone. She's having her little Hallmark moment out there. And it's like you guys said, all of a sudden she's acting like a child, which just it not only baffles me, but it kind of angers me as both an audience member and a writer. And it's like, yeah, this doesn't make any sense. And it's so blatant. You know, we could see the affair coming, and now we can see how this is all more than likely going to turn out, this relationship. You know, it's so put out there. It's like, you know, what was my whole problem? It's like, well, Vanya, you tend to get upset and then things explode. I was like, oh, man, is she going to blow up the husband when she thought the husband was being a little towards Sissy? There's that potential danger. I mean, she blew up the whole flipping world at one point. Vanya's not a very likable character. And her expectations, her 2020 expectations versus the realities, like, you know, even Sissy told her, like, you know, that was just morning talk. You know, that was the morning after talk. You know, like, yeah, we said this. Oh, you said we were going to do this. Yeah, you say a lot of things when you're having a romantic moment. But, you know, like, we haven't known each other that long for one thing, and we just sort of started this relationship just off the cuff. And like you put a detail, you're going to start this little schoolgirl crush with everything going against you. The gay relationship, the single mother, a special needs child. And on top of this, this is also a point in time. Women getting custody of the children is something that's only happened in the last, I don't know, maybe 30, 40 years or so. It used to be quite the thing that if the man wanted custody of the child, it was very easy for him to get custody of the child because he was the breadwinner. He had the money. He was the one who could provide the best life for the child. And so, you know, there's a whole big kettle of just mess that goes along with this whole situation. And the fact that she's not realizing that, or her attitude about it, is just terrible. And it just made me like the character even less.
And that's really a shame, because she does have potential. That she's, you know, written well. Written a little bit more full. Now, you guys said some very key things. Steve really took me back when he talked about the heat that D&D players got back in the day.
I was there.
I just remember that kind of thing happening, and, you know, being warned to stay away from certain stuff, and people going crazy, and they get into deeper levels, and it was this big thing. And I was like, oh, dang, okay, okay. But I remember when that was like a thing, a serious thing.
You guys make me happy. I grew up in California sometimes.
I was in the South at the time, and believe me, this was a real thing even back when I was growing up, so yeah.
Oh, man, I was in South Carolina playing D&D back in the day. That was huge. They were talking about it on the church stations, and then they had that ridiculous movie with Tom Hanks, but he went mad playing D&D.
Mazes and Monsters is a far-out game, yeah.
There was a little bit of that around here, but the people who thought that way, they were the ones that were looked at as they were crazy, not the other way around.
And then we were talking about them actually running away together and making a life. Okay, no-fault divorce kicked in, ironically, in California first, late 60s. Late 60s is when no-fault divorce kicked in. So in terms of, you know, how things would be divided, you used to have a for everybody on this broadcast or everybody listening to this podcast that was born in the 21st century, that means you're 20 years old and younger. You used to have to give a reason you were divorcing someone. And there were a lot of legit reasons besides irreconcilable differences, which is kind of a catch-all. You have to, you could sue somebody, for example, for loss of consortium. What that means is that you're married, but your spouse isn't making love to you, but they are making love to somebody else. In some states, you can still do that, that they're having an affair and they're giving the sex that they owe you to someone outside the marriage. That's still an actionable cause in some states. If there was such a thing as domestic violence, but it wasn't nearly at the forefront. But you had to give a reason. You had to say, well, we're dissolving this marriage because of this, 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 and this. That is such a... go ahead.
I'm sorry. Do you mind if I add something real quick? I forgot to mention, like, because I didn't get to the point of, like, what we would do, what would I do in that place. And I'm looking at the example of rumor. It's like being in a foreign country going back in time. You have to adapt to the culture that you're in, whether you're there by choice or not, because you are out of place. And rumor has to deal with the fact that, unlike being gay, where you could keep that hidden, she's black. There's no hiding the fact that she's black. So she's had to live as a black woman of the time, and she has done an admirable job about it. That makes her so much a better character than Vanya in this series. And I would look at it the same way. If I'm going back in this time, yeah, I might be able to, you know, get a few of my ideals across, but you've got to make those incremental steps if that's what you're going to do. But what's going to be more important to you? If it's going to be the relationship, you know, when in Rome, you're going to have to do as the Romans do.
And speaking of that, that reminds me of yet another thing that's really important. And then we'll get to our last little point here and wrap this one up. And that is dress code. Once again, if you were born in this century, you have no idea what I'm talking about, because in this century, females literally dress any kind of way they want to, at any level, at any point, at any time, any state of dress or undress that they want. But there was a time where women had to present themselves a certain way in public, and that had to do with the length of their dress, the type of heels that they wore, and there was no showing cleavage. They were buttoned up to the neck. And so Allison has that, being a black person, but also being a black woman of the time. And her dress and her hairstyle and her heels all reflect that too, because if she dressed like women dress now any other way, that would be such an immediate standout type of thing. And all of these things, again, Vanya should have been able to pick up on based on the time she's been there. And they almost fell into that relationship a little too easily, honestly. But of course, once again, they have to make the husband an abusive jerk. Like, that's the only husband they know how to write. That's the only husband anybody knows how to write these days. Oh, yeah, he's a jerk. He's insensitive. He's drunk half the time. And, oh, yeah, he's raping me in the marriage. He's forcing me to have sex I don't want to have. And blah, 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 blah. And he has no redeeming qualities. Of course. That's the only way they write men now. Once again, if we went to a time capsule, there was a time. There was a show that used to broadcast way back in the day called Father Knows Best. And it was a show about how the man was the head of the family and about how the wife and the children looked up to dad for guidance. And my dad told me about that show, and then he showed me some stuff. And there's a whole lot my dad holds. His day that he showed me. And it was a time in America where men were respected as the head of the household, and we weren't belittled, we weren't made fun of, we weren't disrespected. And that's unthinkable now, because that's all people do with men. So I'm bringing all these points up to say that they could have gone so much deeper. They have done a good job with Allison. They could have gone so much deeper with the time jump, and with the different social standards, and just with Luther walking around looking like he's roided up all the time. You know what I mean? I mean, people would blink at that. They wouldn't just be like, oh, yeah, he's a big guy. But anyway, last thing I want to touch on, and then we'll wrap this one up, is, of course, the event that the episode is named after, Valhalla, which is the funeral for one of the three Swedish brothers or trio or assassins or whatever. Yeah, it was cool looking, whatever. We've seen that before many times, like we saw in Thor the Dark World or whatever. That's a very common Viking send-off, where they put your remains on a barge and set it on fire to send you to Valhalla. Only problem I had is that it further emphasized that these guys don't really serve a purpose. If Lila and the handler are taking them out on the side, why were they ever there? I mean, I know they're supposed to be chasing the Hargreaves kids or whatever, but I don't know. It just felt like another empty circle. Like, okay, we've come full circle. Now somebody's dead. Do I care? Nope. So tell me what you thought about that scene and the resolution. Start with Bracey.
Yeah, I really have to agree with you. This felt like so anticlimactic. The only thing that was really interesting about that for me is the fact that one of the brothers finally expressed emotion, because they've all kind of acted like the Terminator throughout the series. You know, they're just these kind of relentless machines that are coming after you until you're dead. And then the middle brother screaming in anguish and fury when they light the youngest brother's barge on fire. And, you know, the older one kind of looks at him in acknowledgement. It was like, that was a cool little moment. But it was only one cool little moment out of how then, like you said, they get sidetracked, you know, by the agents and, you know, and killed in a way that's just not really befitting of a good antagonistic foil. It felt very unsatisfying. It felt unworthy of the characters in particular, after we've seen how supposedly relentless and dangerous they are. And then one of them gets just basically punked out. And it really should have been like, you know, after the cool fight with Diego and Five in the hallway, it should have been something better than that. You know, and like you said, if it's just going to be Lila and her handler, her mother taking them out, it's like, then what's the point? What point did they serve?
That's right. What purpose?
Disappointing.
Go ahead, Steve.
I'm going to take this one step further, because I don't think this makes any sense at all. anything involving the Swedes has because we found out the previous episode, I believe, that the handler was the one who brought the Swedes here. What was the point of bringing them there? Was it just to convince Diego to take Lila along? Well, okay, if that's the case, well, then what's your plan for getting rid of them? So you unleash these monsters, basically, and then you have to kill them in a fight. You didn't have any other plan to clear them out of the way once they serve their purpose? Why are they there then? It just feels like, you know, okay, yeah, they're funny at times. Yeah, they're kind of random and interesting as threats. You know, I will say that I did like the Viking funeral scene, partly for the visual. I like the fact that they just used, it's not like a typical Viking funeral where you have a longboat, you know, you just have this little canoe and all of that. It looked like a very rustic, very Texan kind of Viking funeral. And from the visual, I liked it. And I like the middle brother
standing on the boat.
Yeah. 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 And I like the middle brother, like, showing some emotion there. But again, it just kind of brings me back to the fact that the handler's plan seems to be very shaky at best. You know
what I'm worried about, Steve?
Mm-hmm.
I'm worried that this is all going to be some big convoluted plot to somehow regain her position at the agency. And it's not going to work.
Yeah, you could very well be right. I would not be surprised if it is something like that. But then, of course, you're saying, okay, well, I managed to do this. By the way, I got one of your agents killed, because I brought them in without authorization. okay, how does that benefit your plan to get back in the good graces of the commission then? None of this makes any sense at all. But it looks cool. That's more than I can say for the rest of the episode, which was boring and showed nothing. I'll give you that.
Go ahead, Nemesis.
Well, first I'm going to say that for all of you out there, if you're looking for a good time, when I eventually die, this is how I want to go out. I've already told my wife, I have my son practice with the bow. When I go out there on the ship, and I want them to light my butt up, throwing out the ball flames. You're all invited. If you're still around, you can come see me go out to sea and burn up. I'm just putting it out there. You know, save the date. As far as the whole thing with the Swedes, I guess I saw you guys, I saw it a little different from you guys. I thought that it was a clever plan in that she's trying to play both sides against the middle being the Hargrave, you know, the Umbrella Academy kids. And so they'll feel like that Lila will be accepted in and that they're being hounded by the organization and, you know, to set up a lot of disinformation, or not disinformation, I don't know what the word I was looking for, but basically to throw them off their game and to give them a sense of danger and then to allow Lila to enter, you know, come into the group. I thought it was clever how they took the knife and they're going to make it look like Diego set them up. And if anybody's going to do that, it might be someone like Diego that did it. I thought that was all clever. I think the problem is what we've all realized is that five is literally five steps ahead of the handler. Five knows all of her tricks before she knows them. So, you know, five sniffed out, you know, Lila, five sniffed out this problem. Five knows what's going on, and which goes back to my original point for the beginning, which was if all of the other kids just sat there and argued or got high or whatever it is they were going to do, and five just took the rest of the season by himself, it would probably be over in three episodes instead of five, and probably with a better outcome for everybody. So,
and more competently done, because five actually knows what he's doing, and he's not setting them back with stupid drama.
Yeah,
that's right. Okay, we're going to call it there. But so we're pretty much in agreement on most of the episode. And so hopefully everything that's set up that happens after this one is a lot more exciting and a lot more to the point, and hopefully can justify the existence of his characters, which we should not be talking about five episodes into a second season. We should not be asking the question, why are you there? We've been asking that question on some of the villains. Why are you there? So remember, I told you it is unfortunately not the characters that drive Umbrella Academy, but the situation they're in. And so we want to hope that they kind of turn that up and get better in the writing. All right, for Umbrella Academy review, we're going to take a little break, let you hear from our sponsors, let you hear some more of what we're doing on United Capes Podcast Network, and we will be back in five.
One would think that for all the different podcasts that Undercover Capes has, at some point, you would hear from the elusive audio guy. Well, lo and behold, it is I, the audio guy, here to tell you that we have a plethora of podcasts to tickle your fancy, from K-pop cosmos to sloppy spoilers, Flipside Focus to the Capes. Check out all of our podcasts on all of your favorite platforms and at undercovercapes.com.
Right, we're back. We're going to talk about season 2, episode 5 of The Boys, entitled We Gotta Go Now. Just to talk about some initial impressions, this episode for me was the episode where I'll say the noose is tightening, which I know that's a very ugly picture, but I think it's apropos for what's going on here. every situation, every scene, every character, every thing we're presented with is something in that character's life, something either in their past or maybe their present or some type of recent decision where it seems to be catching up with them and always in the worst way. And you can feel the tension building because it's like each one of these things is going to have to be resolved or else the character is not going to be able to go forward. And this is what I mean. This is the difference between being interested in something because you want to see how the story turns out and being interested in something because you want to follow the character's journey. So even though a lot of people thought this episode was boring, there are definitely parts of it that are boring. It progresses each character to a point of no return decision where they're going to have to make a choice. And that choice is going to change everything about their lives going forward. So even though it did go by a little bit slowly, even though, you know, it did have some, you know, holy cow moments as usual, but it, you know, it wasn't the normal thing we expect from the boys, it still pushed the characters into having to make those decisions. So, for example, you know, Maeve realizes she's going to have to do something about Homelander. She was outed on national television. She was forced out. And now they're trying to force her girlfriend. They're trying to make them be a public couple. They're trying to make them do a bunch of things they don't want to do. And Maeve realizes that that's because of Homelander, and he's rubbing it in, and she's going to have to do something about that. Frenchie finds out about Kimiko, what she's been doing in terms of being a hired gun, and Kimiko is still so incredible as a character, but the idea of him trying to save her, or her feeling like she needs to be saved or even wants to be saved, you know, that's, you know, pretty much coming to a head. You're dealing with Annie letting Stormfront know about the stuff she knows, which was stupid. But anyway, but it happened. When you do stuff like that to people that are murderers, I don't know why you don't understand. They're going to kill you. But Annie is still just so ridiculously naive, and that's not right. And it's not supposed to be that way. And we have to try. That's who she is as a character. So, okay. Even with her mother getting involved in the manipulation makes Annie realize, and once again, push has come to shove. You're going to have to do something about what's going on. The Deep makes his wild Hail Mary of taking a wife, and I'm a changed person. I'm doing the commercials for the Church of the Collective, and I overcame my past. And it's that, to me, even though we can't stand this character or his art, it's so apropos of the time when you as a man do something that's heinous or something that the cancel crowd will come after you for. You've got to do an apology tour and rehab your image. And that's what his arc is about. And he takes another step further on that path. And then Butcher, the one who started all this and who normally drives all the action, has to decide what he's going to do about a wife that actually didn't want to run away with him. Everything about Butcher has been leading to the moment where he either takes out the Supes or he takes himself out fighting the Supes. But he found out at the end of last season that Becca's alive and has a kid. So he thought, well, once I reunite with my wife, that'll put an end to all this and we can just ride off into the sunset and we'll be fine, because that's what all this was about. But he found out that's not true. So it's like, what do I do now? And it looks like he's basically just throwing up his hands and saying, I don't have a reason to go on. But of course, he gets a reason through Black Noir, and we'll get there. We'll talk about that when we get there. So even though this episode was slow, and I know a lot of people thought it was boring, but then, of course, obviously, Stormfront and Homer becoming a couple. I don't know if I saw that coming, and I don't know if I like it. First, their relationship was so antagonistic, I thought they were going to throw down at some point, but in a fighting kind of way, not in a lover's kind of way. I was kind of looking forward to that. But now that it's taken this turn, that changes the whole dynamic of everything, them being hooked up. And so I can't quite say yet, in terms of just this episode, I'm not talking about future episodes because I've obviously seen it to the end. But just going on, if I had just watched this episode, I can't quite put my finger on how I feel about that. But in each one of those situations, like I said, they're all at point of no return decisions. They're going to have to make a decision that's going to decide their lives going forward. And that's what I liked about this episode, even though the pacing was a little bit slack. But that's the difference, like I said, you know, when you're following a character, when you want to see what happens to them, when you want to see their choices, their motivations, when you want to see their moral values, when you want to see, when given an impossible choice, what are you going to do? That's always so much fun to watch, as opposed to why are you here? And I can't wait until we get to the whole point. So you guys give me your initial impressions of the episode, because those are mine. I want to hear from you guys. Let's start with Bracey.
Yeah, I'm pretty on board with everything you said there. Unlike this episode of the Umbrella Academy, which I found largely boring, even with the boys, for the most part, even when they have a slow episode, the characters are so interesting, I'm still on board. I don't have to have, like, the knockdown, drag-out fight every episode or anything like that. These characters are very, very fascinating. The arcs that are going through, the machinations, the interactions between characters, and especially, like you said, a lot of these people reach that point of no return. They've had to turn a corner. They've had to make an epic, life-altering decision. And so that's the kind of thing that keeps this show really interesting. I will say on Homelander and Stormfront, totally saw that coming. Although only because I never saw Homelander going this way because it was so antagonistic. But Stormfront had made little allusions like, hey, you know, I can help you out. I can do this. Like, all right, she's going to get in there. She's going to do what she does best. She's going to manipulate him. Get him on her side. Now, I fully expect this to lead to a big knockdown dragout sometime in the future, because this cannot last and it's not meant to last. But I'm really curious to see where this is going to go. And so the boy still manages to captivate and entertain.
Hello? Oops, I was on mute. Go ahead, Steve.
Okay. I have kind of mixed feelings, but more positive than negative here. I feel like the negative really more are, there are just bits of it that are kind of boring. And there are characters that are, you know, doing ultimately what the Umbrella Academy is to a certain extent, and they're pining and they're not doing a whole lot. But at least here, I feel like there's a point to it. So where Butcher is pining, I feel like at least the setup is there. It's like, okay, this episode is him turning the corner and, you know, deciding one way or another what he's going to do about the situation. You know, him, you know, turning the corner, as you've all been saying, but also basically coming to terms with the whole thing and resolving himself to actually take an action. Which is something that I have yet to see Huey do. I have yet to see, like, Vanya do in the Umbrella Academy at this point. So that's definitely, like, a positive step up. And also, like you guys have been saying, the characters make a lot of difference. I want to know more about Homelander. I want to know more about Stormfront. You know, even though these characters are just absolutely detestable on every moral level, they are just so fun to watch, and they have complexity, and they have, you know, layers to what they do, and it's not just one thing or another. I mean, you want to see what they're really trying to accomplish. And of course, you really do want to see Maeve take the stand. You know, what is she going to do about being outed? You know, is she going to take the fight to Homefront? You know, is Starlight going to take a stand against Vodder? Is she going to keep spinning her wheels the way that she has been? So there's at least that. And at least I feel now like the boys are doing something, which is something that the last couple of episodes I really have felt like has been one of the biggest problems. Because we really haven't felt like they've done very much at all. But now with the whole fight with Black Noir, we see things happening. We see Butcher driving the action more now that he is back, and now that he is taking charge, and now that he is, you know, taking the steps towards being proactive in what he's doing. So at least I feel like there's progress being made. And you know, the Stormlander thing, you know, to borrow our portmanteau from the other week, I really like it.
I thought you did that on purpose. Homefront and Stormlander.
But the whole Stormlander thing is, yes, you can definitely tell that there's an antagonism at the heart of it, and they're both vying for power. The whole game that they're playing, with the affair and all of this, it's all part of the game both of them are playing. She's trying to play him. You know, he's trying to see what he can get out of her and to try to meet his own needs. And so you can definitely tell at some point they're going to come to cross purposes. And I have to say that it's one of those things that does feel like it came out of left field, even though I knew it was coming. no pun intended.
Homecoming.
Okay, you totally intended that pun, so don't even mess with it.
All right, not touching that one. But yeah, even knowing that.
Shadewing.
It's interesting. In any case, it's interesting to see where this is going to go in terms of the narrative and where they're heading with it.
Right. Shade Wing. Okay, go ahead. Go ahead, Nemesis.
I'm done. What can I say after that? No, I think you hit it on the head. I think there's a possibility that Homelander and Stormlander, Homecoming, whatever we want to call them.
Oh, my Lord.
Could be an attraction based on some very serious problems, but we'll wait and see what's going to happen with that. For me, this whole episode, the most interesting thing for me is watching Annie and her character arc. To me, Annie is trying to expand her role, or how she sees her role, into being a manipulator, a mover and a shaker, a player, someone who not only can be covert and gather information, but can manipulate people to get them to do what she wants. And she has literally jumped into the deep end of the pool without her floaties on, you know? So she is learning as she goes, and she's not very good at it, but it's interesting viewing. You know, so it's interesting to me watching this character who was a goody-goody, pure as the driven snow little girl, well, you know, or as pure as the driven snow as this show gets in the first season. She's dirtying her hands, and she is on an arc to become a person who, I'm not going to say she's going to become a butcher, but she's moving in that direction. So it's interesting to watch that happen with her. She's making all the moves that you would hope that Huey and his position might make, and he's doing not a whole lot of growth in that way at all. So
now I do want to throw something out. A-Train just touched on it before, but it's very true. The only reason Annie can be who she is and do what she's doing is because of all of her privilege, her different kinds of privileges that she has. Young, cute, female, blonde, all that different kind of stuff. That's the only way she could see life the way she does. It's really, really interesting because A-Train was like, you never mess with the money. You messing with the check. Mm-hmm. You're trying to make the check go away, which is a completely different perspective. And so she's the one character that's allowed, if you will, to still be that wide-eyed after all of this and still be that altruistic or whatever. And it's really something because it's a privilege-based kind of thing. And they hit on it more last year, making fun of evangelical Christians and that whole section, which, you know, they made a point that they were talking about evangelical Christians in particular. But this year, again, Annie still not being as much a part of that scene, but still having that wide-eyed approach. So I can't believe there's this much evil in the world. Only works for her as a character, again, because of her multiple privileges. Because we would not buy that from anybody else. Remotely.
I think that really comes from her that naivete. I mean, whatever you want to feel about A-Train, A-Train is coming from, you know, there's some things you could tell about A-Train. And one is that he probably grew up in a situation where he didn't have a lot of money or security growing up. And so to him, the biggest crazy thing you could do is, like you said, mess with the check. It's like, he's like, I'm not against doing the right thing, but you are taking the food out of our mouth, you know, which is just pure craziest to him. And I understand where he's coming from on that.
Now here's the next issue I want to talk about. I love this because It's a can of worms. And that is Homelander's footage of stopping that supervillain, but killing a civilian in the process and just taking off, not even noticing what he did. That was so Captain America Civil War. That was so the real fear that people would have if soups were real. Collateral damage of civilians. So Homelander, of course, is Homelander. Once he's confronted with what's going on, it drives, you know, the later scenes, and he's, you know, enraged at Ashley, and why didn't you tell me about this, and blah, 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 blah. But I want to hear you guys' thoughts on the concept. We could talk about that scene in particular, but also the concept. What do you do when you have God-powerful metahumans enforcing their brand of justice around the world or keeping you safe or whatever you want to say, but there's collateral damage? Because that was the crux of what drove the action in Captain America Civil War, even though the plot logic was so bad, I just wanted to smash the screen, because Ross blamed them for things that weren't their fault and tried to make it seem like the Avengers did this. And in every case, they were the ones stopping what was happening. And somehow Ross expected them to stop the bad guys and stop the property damage and save all the people. And he spun that whole thing into saying that you need control. And I was like, no, all that is wrong. But anyway, that's a whole other conversation. So, but I do want to hear what you think about that concept. What about the concept of soups running around trying to stop metahuman villains, but innocent people get killed in the process? Non-powered people just get taken out because they get caught in the crossfire, which is literally what happened here. So let me hear your thoughts about that, especially from our military guys. I definitely want to hear, you know, about your experiences there, if you have any. Start with Bracey.
You know, it's I'm glad you took this particular subject, because I've actually written about it rather extensively on Quora. One of my favorite questions to answer are superhero questions, as well as Dungeons and Dragons questions on Quora. And I've answered questions about, like, why superheroes are tolerated. And the main gist of it, if you look at the majority of the DC and the Marvel characters, is the vast majority have the rule that they don't kill, because otherwise they are vigilantes. As long as they aren't killing, they aren't becoming judge, jury, and executioner, they are basically citizens making arrests. And so they get a certain amount of latitude and leeway to do things. In some ways, not unlike, what's his name, Henry Sliwa's, wherever the Guardians that used to hang out in the subways in New York. Forget what that group is called.
The Guardian Angels?
Yes, the Guardian Angels. And there are even people who run around as public superheroes, believe it or not. They dress up in costume. They call the cops when they see activity. And some people actually even get in physically involved, even though I wouldn't recommend doing that sort of thing in the real life.
Kick-Ass.
Because then you have the opening scene of Kick-Ass where you end up in the hospital.
Yeah.
But that allows the government and the police to look the other way and acknowledge the fact that you have particular skills or abilities that are beyond our ken, and you can actually be a very positive thing. Now, when you start getting involved in, like, if you start inflicting whatever your idea of justice is, if it doesn't fit with the populace and the government, you're going to run into serious trouble. And the big problem with that is you're not ever going to fit everybody's idea of what is justified as somebody, you know, who's basically got, he doesn't have a gun in his pocket, he's got a howitzer. So that's a huge can of worms. And once you cross that line, then the fears of the public become realized. And we've seen that done expertly time and time again with things like Chris Claremont's X-Men, Mark Waid's writing of Kingdom Come, other things where it's so easy for the public and governments to turn against superheroes if they cross a certain line. And now that Homelander has decided that he wants to be this global superhero, he's starting to find that out now. Even when he innocently tries to take it, as you said, like you want to take it from a military standpoint. When he honestly say he says, you know, sometimes these things happen. Even police have, bullets travel a long ways. People get caught in crossfires. When you have shootout situations, anything can happen. Things can always go sideways. And you've got to deal with it. But, like, you know, the one guy in the crowd, when he started addressing them out there with the senator, so, like, too much power in one man's hands is, like, that's something you got to deal with. So, like I said, when you cross that particular line, that's when the fear starts to come out. That's when, like, you know, he was everybody's favorite superhero until they started to realize, like, oh, bad things can happen when he's around. Yes, they can. And now you're worried about him. But now it's too late as well.
Well, this is what every time I get into some type of Twitter discussion about Batman and Superman's no killing code, mm-hmm. and how they started out and why they adopted it and where they are now. To me, it's no different from being a parent. When you're a parent, sometimes you have to take a stand on some things that mm-hmm. your kids are never going to understand until 15, 20 years from now.
Yeah.
And you've got to stand firm. They're not going to get it, but you know what you're talking about. And that's what Batman and Superman always do. They know that once we cross that line, where do you stop? Mm-hmm. Once you take all that into your hands and you become all that, where does it end? Go ahead, Nemesis.
It ends with injustice.
Yeah, I think this is such an interesting topic. This is one that's gotten me in trouble a lot of times talking with people because they don't always get my frame of reference, which, you know, I'm glad you brought up military because it's definitely a military frame of reference. I don't think you have to be a superhero to understand that sometimes how much power you have and then deal with it. You know, to me, I think the big qualifier here is how, you know, what your motivation is in acting. It's like, do you have no regard for the collateral damage? Are you taking no, you do care? Are you taking any mitigating action to try and prevent collateral damage? Or are you just being a bull in a china shop going through and you don't care what happens as long as you accomplish your mission, your task, you know? And it's always such a hard trade-off. And I often talk about this with people in the past, and people think that I'm saying that, you know, oh, collateral damage will happen. You know, whatever happens, happens as long as you accomplish the mission. And that's really the furthest thing from the truth. Mm-hmm. You know, I spent 4 years in philosophy classes and officer training, and then, you know, another 8 months in officer basic and officer advanced course, a bunch of different things, learning how to not only make those kinds of orders and live with myself, but take full responsibility so that the men under my command wouldn't have to live with that burden. What do I mean by that? Well, the best example I can come up with is a very simple training exercise we do, but when you stop and think about it, the implications are pretty dire, which is when we're training for biological warfare, we have these little strips that we could test the air for a biological agent or a chemical agent. Well, if those run out, as a fresh-faced lieutenant at 22, somebody that you've worked with for months or years, you have to go to the lowest-ranking person in your platoon and order them to take off their mask and expose themselves and then observe them to see if they die, to see if it's safe for the rest of your platoon to take their mask off. And I think that's the best example I could give of. I mean, there's tons of horrible examples I could come up with, but I think that's the clearest example I could show where you have that power. It's legally within your right. I mean, as an officer, you're legally allowed to execute people in battlefield situations for the crimes of murder and rape as well. It's an awful responsibility, which is why I think you have to be trained and then really think about what you're doing and why you're doing it, you know? And that sounds like a cop-out. It sounds like you're equivocating on morals, but unfortunately the world doesn't always give you a situation where things can be black and white.
The world doesn't always give you those situations. Absolutely right. And sometimes you have to make judgment calls. Go ahead, Steve.
Yeah, I don't know how I'm going to be able to follow those up because I think both of you sum up a lot of the situation. I do have some things that I can kind of add about the scene itself and what I think that they were aiming for with this. One of the distinctions with Homelander in this scene is that he's not necessarily doing what most superheroes do, which is just enforcing the law, acting domestically, to preserve order and law and all that. He is acting as an agent of U.S. foreign policy, going out in the world trying to kill terrorists. And basically, he is acting almost like a soldier for them. And obviously, I think Nemesis and Jeff can probably go into all of that much, much better than I would, even though I know a little bit about it. But I think that what they're trying to do with this scene, or at least what the writers of the episode are trying to do, is they're trying to use Homelander as kind of like a metaphor for how they see U.S. foreign policy, which is they go into these countries, and then they go and throw their way around, and then people end up dying, and then there's an afterthought, and then they come back home and celebrate, and everything's fine. When in fact, the situation is a lot more complex than that. I'm not necessarily going to kind of make any kind of like judgments necessarily about it, because I think it involves a lot more than I really know to comment on. But I think that that's the metaphor that they're aiming for one way or another.
That's pretty appropriate.
Yeah, I'll make a judgment. I will say right off the bat, it's like I think that all of us in the military will admit that we are pretty damn good thing at breaking things. We're not real good at fixing stuff and putting stuff back together.
Yeah, that's true.
There's a great line with there's a Bruce Willis, Denzel Washington movie about dealing with terrorists in, I believe it's New York. And at first they come to Willis about like dealing with a terrorist. And he's like, you don't want us in there. You want to handle it at home. You want to handle it with the FBI and the police. And, the city governor's like, no, we really want you. He's like, let me tell you exactly what it is. The military is a broadsword. Right now, you want a scalpel.
Yeah, it's called The Siege. Great movie.
Yeah.
So yeah, there's just so many different ramifications with that in terms of the legals, the moral, the ethical, and Homelander. His whole thing is that he's just careless.
Yeah. Remember the plane.
Right, but when he's careless,
he loves going to that laser vision first off.
That's right. When he's careless,
and he doesn't care what happens to anybody that he hurts at all. They're ants to him.
Right, that's right. So again, push is going to come to shove, and he has a moment in the episode where he's venting his childlike rage on the crowd. Now, when they first showed the teaser trailer for that moment, I thought it was real. Then I'm like, how was he going to get out of that? But turns out it was just a dream sequence. So they didn't have the courage to go there yet or whatever. Because like you do something like that, you do realize there's no coming back from that, right?
Right.
I'll tell you, when the scene played, I was 50-50 on the fence. It's like he could have finally snapped, or he's wish fulfilling. He's wishing he could do this.
Well, I mean, because it's coming. Somebody of his mental development is going to throw a superpower tantrum at some point.
Yeah.
And when you throw a superpower tantrum, people are going to die. And again, that's why I juxtaposed it so much against Civil War, because they did a good Cap's experience next to Wanda's inexperience. When Cap saw the bomb on his shield, he threw it up at an angle away from the crowd.
Yeah.
When Wanda was trying to contain Crossbones, she took him straight up vertically, and when he exploded, that's what gutted the building. And that just something that subtle shows a difference between training and experience and not. And so with Homelander, it'll be interesting, again, after he throws his tantrum, what that means, because on this show, it should mean the end of him, but we know that it won't, because we know that's coming. Okay, now, the next point I want to talk about is the wink within a wink, story within a story, shade within a shade, because we know we're all good at that, that they're doing on Joss Whedon, Zack Snyder, and the Justice League movie with the Dawn of the Seven. I mean, they're not even trying to be subtle, man. No. they're not even trying to put it out there on a low-key way. They're just blatantly kind of... They're making fun of geek culture. They're making fun of superhero pop culture. They're making fun of those two directors in particular. And they're making fun of their tropes. And I personally think it's hilarious. I think it's just hilarious because it's so on the nose and they're not trying to hide it. So what do you guys think about that? Like, you know, I'm sure you caught all the references and all that, but what do you think about the whole Dawn of the Seven idea and how, you know, it's so funny when Maeve says her lines because they're so silky. Well, because you're special and, you know, they're just so forced and A-Train's throwing a tantrum and then they have the director who I'm assuming is, maybe they're trying to make him be a J.J. Abrams type.
Yeah.
And they're just busting on everybody that's in the superhero mix these days. And I just thought it was hilarious. I thought it was a perfect way to break the fourth wall without actually doing it, but hitting the wink so hard, it's like they're doing it. And but I want to know what you guys thought. So let me hear what you thought, starting with Steve.
Yeah, I kind of have mixed feelings to a certain extent. Some of it was legitimately funny, and I think the stuff that worked for me the best is when they're making fun of like how Hollywood works and how they do these, you know, the rewrites and, you know, the way that the things end up behind the scenes to, you know, bring some of the nonsense to the screen. And you can tell that these people have definitely been through the system and they know how the system works in Hollywood. And because, you know, they're throwing in like reference after reference to things that you would have to be in the know to be able to pull off. So I appreciated that stuff. I'm getting a little tired of Whedon and Geoff Johns getting ragged on, though, because it's like, okay, yeah, we know this was, you know, the movie was not that great. But at the same time, this is the same Joss Whedon that gave us the first Avengers movie. This is the same Joss Whedon that gave us Firefly and Buffy and all these things. I'm just kind of getting tired of him being treated like an A1 hack when he's definitely a better writer than that. It's just that, you know, he was a good writer put in a bad position. Yeah. And I would have liked to have seen a little bit more nuance in the way that they made fun of it. You know, they never take any shots at Zack Snyder. I mean, even though he definitely deserves some for Batman versus Superman, for example. I would have liked, it's just, I feel like there wasn't enough nuance in the way that they were handling the particular people involved. But in terms of the way the industry works and the way that they're taking shots at that, the way they're taking shots at, you know, how stilted some of these lines are and how absolutely schmaltzy and goofy they are. Yeah, absolutely. You know, make fun of that. That stuff is deserved. But I would have liked a little bit of better handling in terms of the actual personalities that were referenced.
Go ahead, Nemesis.
Yeah, I think it's interesting. I think that this whole season and that really this whole series has been interesting for me because I think that they take shots everywhere. You know, they're kind of on scattershot. They're on grape shot. They just put their cannon in the wind and they just fire and they don't care where it lands. And there, I'll be honest with you, especially in these last couple episodes, there are a couple shots that rub me the wrong way. And I'm sure we'll talk about those and why I felt that way and what I thought was good about it as well. But then there are some that I've thought have been, you know, searingly on point, and I appreciate it, you know. So, I thought that their attack on corporate America's embracing various movements, you know, whatever movement you want to talk about, civil rights or LGBT rights or whatever, is based more on money and popularity usually than it is sincerity. I thought that they're brilliant in doing that.
Yeah.
I think they're brilliant in what they're doing as far as lampooning culture and a society where you're in until you're out, and when you're out, you're persona non grata, you know. Mm-hmm. They've done all of that. So I think that it's been some brilliant cultural commentary, and because I think that it has been so brilliant, even when I've taken it not negatively, maybe a little too personally, because they've been brilliant in other ways, it's made me go back and rethink about why I'm taking it personally and what they're trying to say.
That's interesting. Very interesting. We'll come back to that. Go ahead, Bracey.
You know, I really love this. I love the lampooning of the Hollywood system, the blockbuster movie, the whole kind of like rah-rah, go get 'em, women are as awesome as men in every possible way, and even better when we want them to be, sort of thing that's going on lately. And it's so wonderfully pitch perfect, and like you guys have noticed, it's definitely from people who you know, they've worked in the system, so they know the ins and outs, because I find the stuff that's in the movie as well as the behind the scenes stuff equally delightful to me. Like, for instance, you know, like we talked about the stilted lines, like Maeve, like having to tell her co-superhero or the her little contact, where she's like, I'm like you, I'm gay. It's just like, you're just sitting there going like, oh man, that was the worst ever. It's so bad. And I love to hate the focus group guys. You know, they're sitting there going like, all right, you know, and like, we're like, all right, yeah, this comes in like this, and it's going to be like, wham, boom, pow, and like, and here's your wardrobe, and she's like, you know, I don't dress like that. Yeah, but our studies have shown, like, we need a definitive role, like, so we need somebody to be the male and lesbian relationship and the female, because otherwise it confuses the viewers. You know, Maeve is bi. Yeah, that's going to confuse them, too. So you both need to be 100% gay. Yeah. Like, that whole thing, I'm just dying. I was like, oh, God, I can see meetings like that going on and on. And I, one of my favorite things that they cut to is, like, I go back to overall, I enjoyed Avengers Endgame. Infinity War was superior in every way. Endgame wrapped up a lot of things. But, like, there was this one really big cringy moment, because we're shifting away from the male heroes to more and more of the female heroes, which is fine. If those characters are being well written and handled well, and they're good characters, but you know, we've got, you know, Captain Marvel Sue, and who knows where that's going to lead. But I love how they kind of ape that moment, because the big push in this season is like, you know, we've never had three women on the Seven before, and you know, all three of them come together in that scene, like, girls, get it done. And I just flash back to Avengers Endgame, when inexplicably, out of a cast of thousands of people on a battlefield, all the main female characters just end up in one spot at the same time.
Like, yeah, they admitted that's what they were doing.
That's totally what they were going for. Yeah. I was just dying.
All right, I'm Gun Schneider Lee. Twitter hatred is directed at Bracey452.
Bracey 452. Yeah, bring it. I'm all about it. But that was hilarious. I love that these guys have the courage to, you know, they're not only lampooning celebrity culture, which is a big thing about the boys, but they're willing to poke fun at the very industry they work in, both in front of the camera and behind it. Bravo.
I do hit you over the head with the girls get it done thing, and that's going to be a continuing theme, but it's again, it's not subtle. It's very, very blatant. What I want to talk about now is, let's talk about that fight with Black Noir. Now, for those of you that don't know yet, Black Noir is actually a black guy. And oh, yeah, that's what I wanted to say. Those scenes about you need to be 100% gay because we can't sell the half gay thing.
Yeah.
That they used to have something called Blaxploitation films, where they pumped up all the stereotypes of black people. And if you've ever seen
Patrick Jones, baby.
You ever seen a movie called Hollywood Shuffle? Hollywood Shuffle is with that head on. But basically, they tell you, you need to be more black. You're not black enough. You know, you
Robert
can't.
Robert Townsend, black. Folks.
Yeah, you got to be a street black. You know, this is the way you guys talk. You know, you got to shuck and jive and all that. So that's very, very real. That's not a leap.
They even had, was it Blackula and all that other stuff?
Right.
Dude, William Marshall is the shit.
So it's not a leap for them to say, we're trying to sell a very specific stereotypical image or trope here. So you can't be yourself. You can't play the character the way you want. You've got to be, you know, a black street thug. You've got to be a black gang member, because that's what you people do, right? So I have been, you know, my whole life, even when I was in school for music, I talked to quite a few people and I said, I know how you feel about gospel music. I know you think it's poor technique and a bunch of emotional biology, and there's no thought behind it, because that's just what you people do. Like the scene in Blues Brothers, you just flip down the aisles and do trampoline jumps, right? But I have never wanted to shy away from confrontation or education. I was like, no, you're correct. And I educated quite a few people. But the point I'm trying to make is that this is not a leap. They're not making this up. This is real life. This is absolutely real life, whether it's whatever kind of group we're talking about. this is how it's sold, and this is how these images get branded in people's minds through media. Because they say you have to play it this way. You have to frame the shot this way. The character can only be this way because we can't sell it otherwise. It's why George Lucas had to pay for, oh, dang, I forgot the name of the movie. It was the name of the movie about the black pilots.
Oh, Tuskegee Airmen?
Tuskegee Airmen. George Lucas had
Red,
to pay.
Yeah, the Red Tails, I believe, was the name of
the movie. Red Tails.
Because he couldn't get financing because they won't finance a black positive movie. They only finance movies about slavery, if you notice. Only slavery in the 60s, never something like the Tuskegee Airmen. So George Lucas had to pay for that out of pocket. But anyway, so Black Noir is actually a black guy. At least the actor that plays him is black. I don't know if the character is meant to be black. Obviously, I would assume so. But the actor is also black. And if you didn't know that. So let's talk about that fight. Because with that fight, it was one of the few times that I felt like the boys really kind of punked out and backed down. That fight should have ended with just a little bit more tragedy.
Mm-hmm.
Like either Black Noir should have killed somebody in Butcher's family, and that would have fully reignited the old Butcher that we want to see. Not this, oh, I can't live without Becca. Not that one, but the one that we first met. Or Butcher should have killed Black Noir, because that changes the whole game. But, you know, that's just the way I saw it. I was like, okay, because I thought something significant was going to happen, that everybody just backs down. And, like, so that means it didn't need to happen if we're not going to have real consequences. That was my take on it anyway. But I probably did a very bad accent for Carl Urban, but anyway. So let me hear what you thought about it, starting with Nemesis.
Yeah, you know what? I see what you're saying. I understand that they were driving it, the plot a little bit with, you know, Butcher's going to end up getting a call into, Stan Edgar and everything.
Mm-hmm.
If I was writing it, and, you know, this is something we do every now and then because we're writers, so we go into how we would have written it differently. I would have liked to see them explore the standard villain getaway, but from when the villains are the good guys, or at least the guys we're rooting for, and have made it so that the boys had to create a situation where, like, another house was burning or something like that, and then all the people are looking to Black Noir to save the family, and so he has to choose between publicity.
That would have been great.
Letting the boys go, you know. So it's the standard supervillain getaway where they put innocents in danger, but this time we are seeing it from a different perspective. I thought that would have been interesting.
Oh yeah, I kind of thought that's where they were going with it too. Definitely would have been interesting. Go ahead, Steve.
Yeah, I would have thought that as well. Or honestly, I thought what was going to happen was that the aunt was going to die. I thought that Black Noir was going to end up killing her flat out, and that didn't happen. She was an all right character, so I don't feel that bad about it in that sense. But at the same time, it does feel like they kind of contrived the resolution just so everybody could walk their separate ways and, you know, the boys can kind of eke out a win of sorts, which, okay, fine. It was just a little clunky. I don't think it was awful. It was just, you know, could have been better executed, but fine. The one thing I will add is that the character that, for me, stole that whole part of the show was Terror. I love the dog. And he is absolutely accurate to the Terror from the comic books. Down to the breed, down to the way that he acts, down to what Butcher orders him to do at the end of the episode. That is such an Ennis thing to do. So, yeah, he ended up stealing the whole thing to me. As far as the fight itself, I feel like they led up to it in a way that was interesting, but in terms of the way they resolved it, it could have been better.
I thought the dog was going to die. We were going to have a John Wick situation, but I'm kind of glad I was wrong about that. Go ahead, Bracey.
I wish I had thought of Nemesis as his plot device. Man, that would have been great, like flipping the whole script on the typical superhero villain situation to escape. Love that idea, man. That was great. Like Steve, I thought they were totally going to kill off the ant because you need something to spark Butcher. You need something to bring him back to himself. And so we've just been introduced to the ant. We don't have a great deal of emotional connection to him, but we can see that Butcher does. So killing off the ant made perfect sense, especially if it was like in a particularly gruesome fashion, because there was no reason for Black Noir to take so much time with this scene.
Right.
We've already seen him just wade through scads of terrorists and even like a super terrorist with no problem. So, you know, he just kills people super efficiently, super quickly. I will say that I did love the brilliant use of just tension. Like they're all trapped in the safe room, and you hear Black Noir just wandering through the house and the explosion setting off. And then you think, did that one get him? And then you hear the footsteps again, and another boom. Maybe that one was enough. Nope, the footsteps. I love that. That whole, it gives you that whole kind of Jaws vibe. Like, here it comes, real Universal monster movie kind of moment there. You know, or Jason, Friday the 13th. Love that whole thing. He's the Terminator. He's coming to get you. Nothing's going to stop him. Now, another option I would have thought of as a writer, because I know they need to get the boys jacked up on Compound V sooner or later. Mother's Milk got injured. Black Noir just threw a knife at him. How much more interesting would it have been if Noir had basically punched a hole through him like he did to the female when they first encountered each other?
Yeah.
Now you're in a situation where Butcher desperately makes his plea to Edgington, and Black Noir has to stand down. Now the only way to save Mother's Milk is to get their hands on some Compound V before his body just shuts down because he's got this enormous hole in him. And that's where we start souping up the boys. Now they start to end up getting on the same playing field as the female. Now they become together as the actual anti-supergroup. And you can still make this play out to the rest of the season. We don't have to have them souped up until season three because, you know, let's say that Mother's Milk has taken so much damage that even with Compound V in him, it's going to take him a while to get to that level, to where he can actually be efficient, his body all heals up. And we can even play into a thing, even though they don't do it in the show. In the comic books, Mother's Milk has a particular vulnerability. The whole reason he's called Mother's Milk in the comics is he can only live off of his mother's breast milk. Now, obviously, they can't do this in the show. They're too far away from that whole thing because I believe he was born with Compound V already in him. So that's his whole shtick. That's why he gets that name. It's not for the reasons of the show. You can't do that, but this could introduce a similar vulnerability. Like maybe now he can only subsist off of milk. There's some weird thing going on within his system. And so you could build that other bridge from the show to the comics, which would have been kind of cool. That's
well,
what I
think. They kind of do that in a sense with Homelander in terms of giving him that sick addiction.
That's true.
But it's not the same as being the only way you can live. Okay, we're out of time, but I have to throw this in, so let's just be really quick. We got to talk a little bit more about Stormlander and some of the to me, it's the most dangerous pairing I think I've ever seen. This is not even Dark Superman and Dark Wonder Woman. This is Dark Superman and, you know, some type of fascist, Nazi, whatever. And it's just unbelievably dangerous. And he's so naive. He's written it and portrayed so well as such a child. And she's just been drawing him in and drawing him in. And now she's got him. And now I'm like, oh. But it makes for great TV. It makes for a great part of the show. I'm just, you know, like I said, we've obviously seen it to the end, but just up to this point, if this is all I've seen, I was kind of, first time I saw it, I was kind of shaking my head. I was like, oh my goodness, this is going to be trouble.
Talk about a power couple.
Yeah, this is going to be trouble. So let's be brief because we're out of time, but I do want to hear your further thoughts on this couple, then we'll wrap up. Start with Steve.
Yeah, I already talked about it quite a bit. So one thing I'm going to add is I think this is kind of them doing a version of Miracle Man. For those who haven't read it, what ends up happening is that they're basically like an alternate version of Captain Marvel. Except that, what if Billy Batson became like a 40-year-old man and then remembered that he could turn into Captain Marvel? So if you kind of get that idea, you're basically dealing with that. So what ends up happening is there's a kind of a scene late in the run by Alan Moore, which I want to say was Olympus, but I can't remember 100%.
That was it.
Okay, it was Olympus. Okay, yeah. So he gets into an affair with somebody else who's just like him, Miracle Woman, and they make a kind of a big deal of the love scene between the two of them, and you know all of that happening in midair, and like kind of like what they do here, and I wouldn't be surprised if they took a lot of influence from Miracle Man, both in the Stormfront idea and generally with the way that this scene plays out.
Okay, go ahead, Nemesis.
Yeah, I'm going to stay on a purely juvenile level and say that this made me think of possible seismic activity in the area and the possible ramifications of Newton's third law. So,
oh, my goodness. Go ahead, Bracey.
Obviously, these two as a couple is a very dangerous thing. She appears to be his equal in terms of power. But he is by no means Homelander is very cunning, but she is obviously far, far smarter than him. And she is actually an adult mentally and emotionally, as opposed to him being this angsty teenager. And she's going to point him at things like a gun and pull the trigger. This is devastatingly bad news for the boys in the world in general. Now, one thing I did find very interesting, I love the juxtaposition of them having their very rough foreplay, and then surprisingly cutting in between these moments of them actually kind of like tenderly kissing each other. I rather like that, and it gives me a little extra something into Homelander's character yet again. This is like the softer side that he craves, because there's a part of him that understands this is the way it's sort of supposed to be, because he does observe people, but he just doesn't know how to do it. But she does, and she's using every tool in the toolbox to get him.
Yep. I liked your phrase about pointing him like a gun or a missile to wherever, you know, she wants to aim it at, because she's a master manipulator. And we see why very, very soon. Okay, we're going to have to call it there. That's our time. Really enjoyed talking about this episode. Obviously, there's many, many layers. And as we say all the time, this is what good writing does. Gives you so much to think about, so much to talk about. It involves you on so many different levels. It makes you take out what you believe and look at it. And that's reflected on the screen, and that's reflected in your thoughts. And just really, really good to watch. Even with a slower paced episode, still accomplished a lot. I want to thank my co-host. Thank you so much, Steve.
Thank you. And glad to be here and discussing all of these episodes, and we got to go now.
Thank you so much, Bracey.
My pleasure as always.
Thank you so much, Nemesis.
No problem, and look up Newton's Third Law, folks.
And thanks to our audience for listening, and we will see you next time on the next episode of Sloppy Spoilers.